your passion lies in elite British road racing and you want an inside line on the teams, riders, organisers and sponsors that make this sport such a compelling spectacle, you're in the right place. I'm Timothy John, and joining me for every episode is my co-host, the Managing Director of Brother UK, Bill Jones.
Thanks, Tim. It's great to be here. We're going to use this platform to talk about all the key issues surrounding the sport. With special guests, deep dives into hot topics and plenty of chat, we'll keep you informed about all things UK racing. Stay tuned.
Hello and welcome to this new edition of the Brother UK Cycling Podcast, where I'm delighted to say we are back in the studio in Manchester. It's been a brilliant day. We've already had a packed studio with guests, including Daisy May Barnes of Brother UK Orientation Marketing and Ian Watson, the manager of Brother UK LDN. We're into the afternoon session now, and the soldiers hanging with us throughout this afternoon are Adam Kenway, the former British hill climb champion and multiple podium finisher at the National Hill Climb Championships. Adam, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Oh, thank you for letting me stay and having me here today.
And also joining us, staying with us, I should say, is Tony Barry, the manager of Neutral Service powered by Brother UK. Tony, thank you very much for sticking around.
You're welcome.
And of course, my co-host is here, Managing Director of Brother UK, Phil Jones. Phil, thanks for staying with us.
Good to be here, Tim. Let's get into this Tour of Britain chat, eh?
Absolutely. Tour of Britain. I mean, just the pinnacle men's race in Great Britain, as the name suggests. It's going to be on us sooner than we think. It starts on Sunday, September the 4th, and finishes a week later on Sunday, September the 11th. This is the 18th edition of the modern Tour of Britain, a race, of course, that began life as the Milk Race. There are eight stages this year, and it truly is a Tour of Britain. It starts in Aberdeen, it ends on the Isle of Wight. I can tell you for a fact that Andy Hawes, the route director, is out as we speak, driving every inch of this route. I'm meeting up with Andy on Saturday afternoon down in Dorset, so it would be great to hear how he's getting on. But here's what we know so far. Stage one, Sunday, September the 4th, Aberdeen to the Glenshee Ski Centre. Stage 2, Monday, September the 5th, Howick to Duns. Stage 3, Tuesday, September the 6th, Durham to Sunderland. Stage 4, Wednesday, September the 7th, Redcar to Duncan Park. Stage 5, Thursday, September the 8th, Westbridge to Mansfield. Stage 6, Friday, September the 9th, Tewkesbury to Gloucester. Stage 7, my neck of the woods, West Bay to Ferndown. And Stage 8, Sunday, September the 11th, a spectacular finish on the Isle of Wight, starting in Ryde and finishing at the Needles. This is truly an ambitious race, Phil. This is a really comprehensive route from one end of the country to the next.
It is indeed, and I wouldn't like to be doing the transfers for this year's Tour of Britain. I must tell you, having participated in 2018 and done it one day ahead, the transfers are really part of the entire setup, which can be the real fatigue build up. Is, you know, it's difficult racing, and it looks like it's a pretty hilly edition of the Tour of Britain yet again. So difficult parcours, but of course the sheer distance from going from the top of the country right the way down to the Isle of Wight, they're going to be covering some miles in those team buses.
And how does a Neutral Service crew, you know, manage those long transfers? We know that it's very difficult for the riders, particularly the leaders who've got media duties. Everything's delayed. It can be up to 10, 11 o'clock at night before they get to their hotels. Is it an onerous part of the race for you guys, these long transfers?
I know it's not comfortable in a team bus, but at least you can sleep or try and get some rest and get your feet up. If you're not driving, you can sleep. And I'm sure that's what the majority of riders will do.
Adam, you haven't ridden the Tour of Britain, but you've ridden the Tour de Yorkshire. You've ridden some very big stage races. What are the physical demands of a long transfer? Is it the last thing you need at the end of a day of racing?
Sort of. So it's amazing how quickly they go, especially because you're just talking about the race, what's happened and what you're going to do the next day and the next stage and what's gone wrong and right. The main thing from my side of things is getting nutrition into me. So let's say if the hotel, you don't get there till 11 o'clock at night, you have to make sure you eat properly. I can remember once I was doing okay and I got called in for anti-doping. So time anti-doping finished, I didn't think we left the finish of the race till like 7:30 at night. I knew we wouldn't get to the hotel about till like 10:30. I've set meals for you. They're, that kind of all been cleared away. So we had to call in for some fish and chips on the way back. And probably not the most nutritious food you can get, but it's all part of it. I think the World Tour teams where they've got the really big motorhomes and the basically on-site kitchens almost, that does help them a lot compared with some of the small Conti teams where they are sitting in the back of a car. Anybody who's had 4 or 5 hour just commute or drive to holiday, you're tired after the end of it. And if you imagine that's after a back of, let's say, a 5 hour race plus a 2 hour transfer to the start of the race can really build up. I'm very lucky as well. Once my head hits the pillow, I'm off to sleep instantly, where I know riders who need to be in bed for a good 2 hours almost before you actually fall asleep. So for them, it's even more of an issue.
I was lucky enough, Tim, to have a couple of tours around some of the World Tour team buses. So I've been in a few of those in my time. And yeah, I mean, the big budget teams, those tour buses are something else inside. They really are. And yeah, absolutely, they're total luxury. But like you say, the other end of the spectrum, if we think about some of the maybe the Conti teams from the UK, the UCI teams who are going to be competing, they don't have that same luxury. So you're right, it's either in the back of the car or in the van with the mechanics doing the transfer. That's a very, very different Tour of Britain experience that they'll have, albeit I know they'll all really enjoy it and all the riders just want to be in the race. But that additional layer of organisation, which means that literally you're beginning to recover from the moment you get on the coach. I mean, these coaches, they've got showers in, kitchens, all the riders got their own areas where they can have their food pre-prepared for recovery. So as soon as they're on, they're eating. The chefs have got all the optimum amount of nutrition being prepared, ready for the next day. So they're arriving at the hotels in a far more prepared condition, ready for the racing the next day, whereas perhaps some of the smaller teams and certainly some of the domestic teams here are unfortunately in the lap of the gods sometimes when it comes to organising things like that.
Absolutely. When you see these huge gleaming team buses, you can think, well, this is all for show. This is all a larger background for the sponsor's logo. But there is an intensely practical purpose to these very expensive, very luxurious vehicles. And as you say, Phil, that's to aid and to speed that process of recovery. I remember 2018 Tour de Yorkshire, Harry Tanfield, of course, won the opening stage, which meant the following day he was in the leader's jersey. And I interviewed Harry in the back of a Ford Transit van, not even a Ford Transit van with windows on the side panels, but a Ford Transit van. And he was sat there with the Tour de Yorkshire leader's blue jersey with his race numbers pinned on the back. And when I'd done the interview, I slid the door back, jumped out, walked around the corner to a car park full of the most luxurious team buses you could imagine. And I thought, well, that is the difference. You know, that's what a difference in budget means.
It's simple as a shower. Obviously, get out your kit and put fresh clothes on and try to wash as well as possible. But over a stage race, obviously, you don't think it, but saddle sores are a big, big issue. And if you can get in a good shower and get clean really properly, you can relax a lot more easily for that transfer, where most riders won't get a good shower until they get back to the hotel. And it's just some little things we just don't think about.
Yeah, I mean, these are all the small details, aren't they? And I'm just thinking then that if our listeners get time to go back and listen to episode 20, which I recorded with Sophie Smith in London, it was about her new book, Pain and Privilege Inside La Tour. And so what Sophie tries to do is unpack some of the realities of what it means to race the Tour de France. She started talking about things like the app, the Jumbo Visma riders have, which actually pinpoint their nutrition down to the individual, down to the time of day, down to the gram of food that they should be eating to optimize their individual performance the day after. Now, that really is kind of quite something. Now, it also flashed into my mind then of when James and I did the Tour Britain One Day Ahead in 2018. One of the things I used to love at the end of the day is I knew Sherry would be there with a cold flannel, and she'd just say, right, sit there. And we'd sit on the back of the car and she'd just wipe our faces, rub our legs down. And honestly, I began to really look forward to that moment in the day, because you just sort of, you didn't realize the grime that you picked up off of the roads, you know, fundamentally. Then she'd just shove some food towards her way and she'd say, get eating. You're eating for tomorrow all the time. She'd always be out the window. You're eating for tomorrow. You're eating for tomorrow. So these nutrition particularly, and you know, when you're talking about riders of your capability, Adam, and these World Tour riders, when you get an upset in that rhythm, it can really change a rider's performance on the road. And the Jumbo Visma guy who was organizing all this nutrition was basically saying, look, you know, if someone rides poorly, we know immediately what they've eaten or what they've not eaten. And we can pinpoint their performance often down to nutrition above all else. So I thought, well, that's fascinating. So all these dynamics are going on behind the scenes, aren't they? As we're watching this, just this sort of 8-day spectacle rolling around the UK, it's all wonderful. But all of this stuff goes on behind the scenes in race organisation and team organisation.
Absolutely. And that, Tony, must be night and day from when you entered the sport back in the 1960s, to think that you could get dietary advice from an app on your phone, and yet that's what Jumbo-Visma's riders can rely upon. And yet you had a front row seat to arguably the biggest change, which was when Dave Brailsford became performance director at British Cycling. You were on the board of directors. That whole culture that's entered the sport now, the aggregation of marginal gains, you saw that firsthand, didn't you?
Yes, it was good. It worked out well. And it's like, as he says, marginal gains, just the little bits that make it. That guy at the finish with the cologne makes it for that rider so that he knows that, okay, he's not clean, but at least his legs have not got the muck and his face feels that much better.
Yeah, and how different are things now from when you were managing the GB road team, for example?
I should imagine there is still things like that that go on. You only have to look at the finish of any race where it is a big team and there's guys waiting to look after them. And when they go into, if luckily they've won, you can see the Swanier sorting them out before they go on the podium, which is all part of making that rider ride his bike.
Yeah, absolutely. All of these highly sophisticated processes, whether it be diet, whether it be rest and recovery, whether it be the high-tech bicycles, it's all about making the riders perform. Let's go back to the course because, you know, that's absolutely fascinating. Hilltop finishes this year on the opening and the final stages. Only one of the eight stages has less than 2,000 metres of climbing. That's stage five from West Bridgeford to Mansfield. And the race ends, interestingly, only 1 week, exactly 1 week, before the start of the 2022 UCI World Championships in Australia. The Tour of Britain, I think it's fair to say, has really benefited from its position on the calendar. It's almost the final preparation for the World Championships. Will that be so this year, do you think? Would you need more than a week, Adam, if you were an athlete preparing to perform in Australia?
I think the top athletes will be okay. The only issue they'll get is the temperature difference. It could be cold that time of year. It could be 2 or 3 degrees in rain you're riding in. And obviously in Australia that time of year, I think it'll be about 32, 33 degrees. So some riders might struggle to acclimatise in time. But it's going to be a hell of a hard race, Tour Britain, especially with a really big hill on the first day. Anywhere where it's finishing at a ski resort, I'd love it. And it's going to be great to watch. It's going to be hard. And even that the Mansfield stage, which you're talking about, I live very close. The roads are hard, up and down all day, twisty. It's going to be really hard racing.
Yeah, just in terms of those British roads, which are heavy, which are grippy. As a rider, as we say, you're a veteran of the Tour de Yorkshire. Does that give the domestic riders not an edge, but something to hold on to when they race against the World Tour pros?
It certainly does. You know how the roads feel. And some riders, European riders, who dread coming over to race because it's so hard. And they call it slow motion racing because you're going just as hard. But on the continent, you just fly. And you're watching it on telly, and you're watching the Tour de France, the emotion along. And they're putting exactly the same effort in. But in the UK, they're going probably 3 or 4K an hour slower. And it means you're losing all the momentum over the bumps, and it's just hard racing throughout. But it does mean for a really worthwhile victories. Like if you look at the top contenders last year, they're the very, very best in the world champions. And because the hard roads, it just brings cream to the top.
Phil, do you think we're going to get a world-class field this year? Or do we think, you know, the likes of Van Aert, Alaphilippe, if they got an eye on retaining the rainbow jersey in Alaphilippe's case, will he head to Australia as soon as he feasibly can?
I think my feeling would be yes. I mean, we're looking at a 9-hour time zone difference between the UK and Sydney. So, you know, that's quite big. So you want to try and acclimatise to that, in my view, and get adjusted to that as quickly as possible. So it may well be that those, you know, really big stars might end up heading out to Australia a little bit earlier. So, you know, Tour Britain may suffer a little bit as a result, with some of the real big names maybe choosing to head Australia way beforehand. But I don't think it would detract from the race fundamentally. Tour Britain's a fantastic spectacle. It will still have a star-studded feel, let's be honest about it, that even some of the riders that perhaps aren't the really big superstars, like the Alaphilippes, there's still plenty of riders who can put on some fantastic racing. And I was looking there that I can remember we rode that West Bridgeford to Mansfield stage in 2018. I think it will be the longest stage because it was, when we rode it, it was about 228K, I think, from memory.
Ian Stannard won it that year. It was a brutal day.
Yeah, it was a long day out, without a doubt. I think for many of us, it was the longest we'd ever been in a single day on a bike. And I think on that day, I had Emily Meakin with me as well. That was the furthest Emily had ever been on a bike in one day. And obviously Emily was active in the women's nationals at the weekend. So So it's a long old day, and especially we've got a few heavy days climbing in the legs as well. It's not an easy day by any feat of the imagination if it's a long day. If it's relatively flattish, I think, relative to the rest of the course, but that doesn't mean it's not going to be going to get a build-up of fatigue after such a long stage.
You're saying, Phil, that regardless of whether the very biggest stars come, we're still going to get a decent race. I think you're absolutely right. I think the Tour of Britain must have a lot of credit in the bank now. This is the 18th edition of the modern tour. We've had great winners, you know, year in, year out for pretty much all of that period. Tony, how different is the modern Tour of Britain from the Milk Race, its predecessor?
I think it's the riders that make it. I mean, the riders that come now are professional. I think that's the word to say. And the backup that they've got. I mean, it must be one of the top stage races in the world. I know we've got the Tour and the Giro, but the Tour of Britain is one to win. Definitely, if you can get that on your list of wins, it's a good race.
I mean, you were inside it last year when Neutral Service Powered by Brother UK got the call up from race director Mick Bennett to support the Tour of Britain and the Women's Tour. You led the Neutral Service crews in both races. What was it like being in a professional convoy?
It was good. It was good. I mean, luckily for the people that I've got with me, they have done it in other stage races. So I've got guys who did the Milk Race, mechanics in the Milk Race, and also on the continent with British Cycling. So the guys that were with me knew what was coming and knew what would happen.
So you certainly weren't overawed, you weren't fazed by the occasion?
No, definitely not. It is a cracking race.
Tell me about the, I mean, you must know every DS on the domestic scene, you must know every commissaire, every marshal almost. Is it the same cast of characters at the Tour of Britain?
It is. I mean, the guys come over from the continent to be commissaire president, and there is other ones come as well. The majority of people that are doing cycling in England are there, and British Cycling is part of that.
And what about sharing the road with drivers from World Tour teams who clearly wouldn't know the British roads as well as you do? Is there a hierarchy? Did you find that you were able to integrate quite easily into that world?
I don't think there is a problem. The majority, with us being Neutral Service, they will let us get through because one day they might need us. That's the thought, or that would be my thought as team manager. Let them get through. Don't put any obstacles in their way.
I can probably bring a bit of insight to this, Tim, that when I jumped in the team car for the Tour de Yorkshire, actually, with Chez, it was very evident at the time that there is a perceived pecking order that regardless of what your convoy position is, that, you know, the World Tour drivers of the team cars very much seem to want you to defer to them. But of course, when you've got someone like Sherry behind the wheel, who's a very, very skilled driver, I mean, literally, she could drive a rally car on the best rally stages in the world and be competitive, I'm sure. And you've got to have a certain confidence, I think, behind the wheel when you're driving the vehicles too. So in my experience, everybody who drives in a Peloton is a very, very, in most cases, capable driver. And everybody understands that ultimately it's always about rider safety first. You know, just don't be an idiot on the road. You've always got to be thinking of the riders. But if occasionally team cars do a few shenanigans, you know, they've got their position in the convoy, they might be late dropping back, they've gone up to service a rider and they'll stay up a bit, and of course, you know, you get a few beeping horns and flashing of lights, so, you know, get moved back, oh sorry, it just goes on. These are the things again that are the nuances that happen behind the racing. But as Tony says there, I think with Neutral Service, because you are under direction of the race commissaires, then nobody wants to get on the wrong side of the commissaires. And for Tony at the end of a race to be saying, oh, Team A, Team B or Team C, we're holding us up on the day and our ability to deliver service to riders.
Phil makes a very good point there about the skill of the driver, something else that's completely missed by television coverage. How do you pick a driver, Tony? How do you know if somebody's got the right temperament, the right skill, even before you put them through the IAM or UCI training?
I think the ideal guy is a rider. He'll know how to do it. And then it goes on from there then. They have to do the UCI accreditation and British Cycling one. And it's time.
But Tim, isn't it funny that, can you imagine for a moment though, that obviously, you know, we've talked about the Milk Race there. And so cast your mind back to 1987, you know, when Malcolm Elliott won the Milk Race that year. What must that convoy have looked like with a collection of Morris Marinas and Allegros and all sorts of manner of vehicles without ABS, without power steering, without crash protection radar, all of these things that go on. Those cars, by any measure versus today's cars are very, very different. We've got much more advanced braking now, haven't we? And cars today are very, very different. But still, it's an individual behind the wheel, regardless of what vehicle that is. So providing that individual's got that awareness. And as Tony says, when somebody's an ex-rider behind a wheel, they've got that sixth sense. I think we've mentioned this before, that sixth sense about how a bunch is moving, keeping an eye on things. And in fact, I spoke to Dean Downing about this. Obviously, Dean Downing was driving the Commissaire President, I think, at the Women's Tour. Dean's one of our national superstars when it comes to racing. And he said he's in constant dialogue with the Chief Commissaire about the car, where it should be positioned. He's listening to Dean about what might be happening in the bunch ahead. So Tony's point there is well made, that a former rider makes a great driver.
Yeah, 100%. Is that universally true, though, Adam? Would you fancy yourself behind the wheel of a team car or a neutral service car?
I've been in the passenger side of a team car before, and it is a different experience, and it's what I enjoyed. From the rider side of things, I've always felt safe in the cars. 99% of the drivers know what they're doing. Really, you're touching the back bumper most of the time, because that's the way you're taught. You're taught to stay as close to the car as possible, and then they back off before the bend so you can overtake. I do think it's a skill riders probably would be the better at, because you do know braking distances and what you would do in that scenario. You'd know where the rider's going to go, what line they're going to take around the bend, so you know where to place the car. I've had probably one incident before where I thought, oops, this is not where I want to be. And that's in Cycle Classic. And that's just because I think the lanes are really, really narrow. And I just had a wheelchair and I was just getting back on. And I was just coming past Chez and the road disappeared. And I can remember basically me getting dragged by the side of the car for a second, which was a bit scary. It's a tough job, especially if you think you're going to be in there for 5 hours. You've got to be really on your guard for 5 hours, because there's always bikes going up and down, getting food, getting bottles, getting dropped. And there's also an etiquette as well. So if you've got mechanical, they will help you get on. If you're getting dropped, that doesn't happen. Getting food and things like that. And I'd only get bottles and things like that if I saw Ineos or another team getting bottles, because I knew, okay, they're probably going to be the team making the splits and things like that. So I'll go back with them. And also, you know, there's a couple of strong riders to help you back onto the bunch, because we've all been in the scenario where a couple of times I've gone back for bottles at the wrong time. And you just learn it as a rider. And then your race is over. Before you know it, something's gone off up the road. Pace gets put on. The chief comm opens up the gap between the car and the bunch. And that 100 metres can be extremely hard to get across if you've not got the best legs on the best day.
I think we're getting a sense here of how absolutely integral the race convoy is to the race. We said, didn't we, in part one of this episode, it's the race within the race. And everything we're hearing now just reinforces that opinion. Let's stay on track with the Tour of Britain and discuss this particular route in a bit more detail. We've said earlier that it's again a very, very hard route. Last year was extremely difficult. I mean, is that the right direction? I'm just playing devil's advocate here for a bit. We know that harder races don't always produce the best racing. And as much as a hard parkour will attract a certain type of rider, it will dissuade another type of rider from coming. I mean, Caleb Ewan and Dylan Groenewegen won stages of the 2019 Tour of Britain. There would have been nothing for them last year, nothing for them probably this year. Rowan Dennis won the time trial last year. There's no time trial this year. Is it a double-edged sword, Tony, do you think, planning these increasingly harder routes?
It is. I mean, some people used to say that the Tour of Britain will only be won by a few seconds. But even if it's won by a few seconds, they're flat out every day. There's no messing around. You've got to be up there to win it. And the riders will do that. And the general public want to see things happen. And if there's climbs, you'll see riders suffer. It's a terrible thing to say. That's what the general public want to see. Somebody with their nose on the top tube trying to get up a climb.
And what's the feeling inside the peloton, Adam, for hard, challenging races? That 2018 Tour of Yorkshire that we were talking about earlier, my goodness, particularly stage two, I seem to remember, that finished in Ilkley up the Cow and Calf. I mean, that was absolutely savage and raced from the gun. What do the sprinters feel when they're sat on the start line for a stage like that?
It's definitely a divide in the bunch, and a divide in the hotel. It's quite funny. So the night before and the breakfast in the morning, you go down for breakfast, and if you imagine it's a big hall and each team has got a different table, and you walk in and you can see the expressions on the different riders' faces. Like, today I'm going to be suffering. Or like for me, I'd go in cheery. I'm always going cheery. I prefer to have a positive mental attitude. But yeah, some people's race, they just think, okay, I just need to get through this day. And you can see they just, even in the morning, piling on the rice and things like that. But again, even the easiest stage can be made hard by the riders. If anything, this year's Tour of Britain will be even harder because more people think they can win it, which can make it even more open and could split the race apart even more, which I think is going to be really exciting. Because instead of three or four riders thinking they're going to win it, it could be 10, 15, especially with some of these climbs. And if a break gets away, I feel like some of these stages could be a good breakaway stage. Like I think 2017 or 2016, Steve Cummings won and he attacked going over the top of the Cat and Fiddle and stayed away, got a gap, and that gap he held for the rest of the race. I think it could be very similar to that. I love hard racing, I must admit. That's why I bike race, really. Obviously, sprinter stages have got them, but even anybody in a bike race, there's not many sprinter stages which are actually easy. You still got to get to the finish with good legs. Another view, and some people love them races, but I prefer kind of hard, gritty racing, which the Tour Britain this year is definitely going to be for me.
And I think back to your point there, Adam, that regardless of what's going on in the World Championship, the Tour Britain is still a race to have on your palmares. And if we think about the last three winners of the Tour Britain, we had Van der Poel, Julian Alaphilippe, Wout van Aert. Three huge names in global cycling have all won this race. And then we're going back and Edvard Boasenhagen, Bradley Wiggins, these are the top racers in the world want this race on their palmares amongst all of those other races, whether it be stages at the Giro or the Tour de France or the Vuelta or the One Day Classic. So this is still a highly desirable race. That's the point, is regardless of what's going on with the world, there will be as many riders looking at that one thinking, as Adam says there, well, look, if a load of people are going to go that way, this could be my best chance ever to win the Tour of Britain. That should make a more active race, I hope. And if it does, then that might be good for us all, I guess, the fans watching it.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Nowadays, more than ever, win any race from a third cat or fourth cat crit to last night where I raced Otley, to win it, you've got to be good. You can't just coast and you can't fluke it. Everybody knows what they can do and team managers are there giving you good instructions. Everybody has got the eye of the tiger and want to win. And there's no gimmies nowadays. There's nothing at all.
Where do we think then, with all that in mind, the Tour of Britain stands in the sort of pecking order of world events? Sweet spot, the organisers, they've never made any secret of the fact that they want it to be the fourth most prestigious race in the world. They acknowledge they can't compete with the Grand Tours. Britain, by its very nature, by its geography, you're never going to have a three-week bike race here. But of all the others, they've said right from the get-go, we want this to be the best. And when you think about, the other top week-long stage races, Paris-Nice, Tirreno Adriatico, Dauphiné, Tour of Suisse, Phil, where would you place the Tour of Britain in the sort of hierarchy of week-long stage races these days?
Thanks for giving me that one, Tim. Yeah, can I have an easy one? Here's my opportunity to upset cycling fans across the planet with my answer. And of course, as a UK-based individual, of course, I'm going to say the Tour of Britain is the place to be. But I think probably for a lot of the British riders who've grown up here, they all want to come back and maybe have that one on their palmares. I mean, look at Bradley Wiggins. He had a number of races he wanted to always win, didn't he? He had Paris-Roubaix, which he ultimately never did, but he wanted the Tour of Britain. He wanted the Tour de France. He wanted all of these iconic races on his palmares. And I do understand that. So I think it's right up there. And I think that's the point. Is it the best? Well, I think you could argue the nuances of that. But actually the reality is it as good as? Yes, it is. Without a doubt, it's as good as. But as Adam says, it's a very different kind of racing. Our roads are super grippy. We know that. People who are listening, who are riding them, every weekend, full of potholes. The surfaces aren't great. We've all got one place on our ride routes that might have been re-tarmac sometime in the last 20 years, which you suddenly reach and go, oh, that's wonderful. Oh, my handlebars are not vibrating. I'm not trying to dodge a pothole now. Riders that love hard racing always enjoy the Tour of Britain. That's the one thing I've heard. A lot of the riders from the continent, maybe who are used to riding on smoother parkour, yeah, of course, they'll be complaining that it is a bit of a rough and ready race, and the weather obviously can be unpredictable. But again, that's all part of the narrative around the race, isn't it? There's easier additions, there's harder additions, there's different riders, there's different weather conditions. But ultimately, ask any rider, would you like that on your palmares at the end of your cycling career? I think they'd all answer yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you've hit the nail on the head. Is the Tour of Britain a better race than Tirreno Adriatico? Who knows? Is it as good? 100%. That's an easy answer, isn't it? Keep coming back to this, Tony, but you've been in the sport a lifetime. How does it compare to to the milk race. Would the milk race ever have had that international reputation?
I think it did. And if you go back, we used to have a race called the Peace Race, which was in Czechoslovakia. And luckily, I was one that went to the Peace Race as a manager, and it was unbelievable. I know people say that it is not as good as the Tour de France or the Giro, but it was a different race. You know, when it was behind the Iron Curtain, they made a different race altogether. And if you were able to finish the Peace Race, I think you are a rider. It's a different world we live in now. The Tour of Britain has the problem with traffic. The way the police control the traffic to get the Tour of Britain through, I don't think any other country has that problem. You know, that we are such a densely populated country, to get the Tour of Britain through it takes some doing.
It is an absolute masterpiece of organisation. Phil, as somebody who runs a large organisation, what's your handle on the Tour of Britain putting on this race year in, year out?
Yeah, I mean, it's a logistics masterpiece, thinking of everything that they have to put together. Look, there's the basics of the hotels and the route, and Andy's doing all the route planning and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, I think my great admiration comes to people like the guys from National Escort Group and also from, you know, the Police Outriders, keeping that rolling bubble moving in a dynamic environment. And it is a dynamic environment where the whole thing just moves with a closure either side of it. It has all sorts of potential there for things to go wrong. Of course it does. So it's really down to the mastery and the organisation of everybody, including the people on the ground, to make sure that that thing goes through smoothly and that huge convoy can continue to go. It's absolutely a huge, huge piece of organisation, which probably people don't quite realise. They just sort of maybe stand at the side of the road and wave and think it's marvellous that, you know, this whoosh as all these riders go by and then all these cars go by. But for that to happen in itself is months and months and months of planning, a lot of detailed work being done with local councils all the time, because of course there's all these bylaws about what roads can be used, can't be used, all these conditions, they've got to be signed off by all these councils, and then the route's got to get published, and Andy obviously is doing his second drive of the route this week, because of course suddenly a roadworks pops up from nowhere or pothole appears on a major part of the route and negotiation with the council is we may not get it fixed in time, so they've got to do a reroute. So all of this stuff is going on in the background before the riders finally get to the line. It really is, it's a huge job.
And does any of that even cross your mind, Adam? I guess the highest compliment is that it doesn't. You just turn up and race.
You just turn up and race. It is amazing, just as you drive into the start area and just from 4 mile out, there's signs and people guiding you into where you need to park, and every team's got its own spot, and obviously then they're barricaded off so nobody, no cars can come in. But again, on the other side of things, I think it's one of the best sporting events in the world where people can just walk up and have a word with you. There's no other event in the world, I don't think, where you can go and chat with Anna-Philippe warming up on the bike beforehand and things like that, which I think it's great. You can get so hands-on to the riders and you can see the event. You know the route before it, so you can probably see the race probably 4 or 5 times on the same day. I think it's just amazing. I can remember, I think I was probably 7 or 8, and all I knew was 2 bike races, the Tour de France and the milk race. And it came near me up a climb called Thorncliff. I rode a bike, but my dad didn't let me on the road at that point, and it was so steep. And my dad used to go up on his old Vauxhall Cavalier, and it was a steep hill. And I didn't think anybody could get up that climb on a bike. I can remember my dad taking me to watching the milk race there, and we followed the race for a bit. And I can remember nabbing the yellow signs they used to have to direct. And I wish I still had that sign somewhere. I had it in my bedroom for years, this yellow milk race sign. From a UK perspective, I think there's only 2 races really at this time. There was Tour de France and the milk race. And so from my point of view, Tour of Britain's up there with any race in the world, really.
And it's worth noting that obviously there was a 5-year hiatus, wasn't there, between what was the milk race, which became the Kellogg's Tour, which became the Prue Tour, sponsorship, all that sort of stuff, names changing. But from 1999 was the last time what was the milk race was raced, when it was called the Prue Tour. And it was Sweet Spot that brought that back in 2004 as the Tour of Britain. And kind of nobody's looked back from there, really. So I think, you know, all credit to Sweet Spot, because, you know, they've run it every year, other than, of course, pandemic year 2020, they've put the race on.
You know, somebody, I think it was Ian, mentioned in part one, you know, the 2008 Beijing Olympics changed the landscape of cycling in this country. The job was almost done before 2012, wasn't it? I know 2012, it went supernova, but it was 2008 that changed everything. And when you say, Phil, that the first edition of the modern Tour of Britain took place in 2004, and nobody was clamouring for cycling in those days, you know, the editors of Sunday supplements weren't desperate to put cyclists on the front cover in the way that they were post-Beijing. So credit to them. They've lived through the hard times in the past. And, you know, that will stand them in good stead now we find ourselves in a very challenging economic climate. Let's bring the story right up to date with the announcement today of the British teams they're going to be riding in this year's Tour of Britain. That's the Great Britain Cycling Team, of course, development team from British Cycling, the National Federation, Ribble Worldtight, a UCI Continental team. Of course, they all are the remainder. Sampiran from Cornwall, Trinity Racing, and with Sungod. Adam, you'll have an interesting perspective on this because, as you mentioned at the top, you haven't ridden the Tour of Britain. It seems inconceivable given what else you've achieved in domestic racing, but your sort of run at it came in a very strange year. You were riding for Vitus Pro Cycling powered by Brother UK back in 2018, and that was a season in which points scored in the National Road Series acted as a qualification entry for the Tour of Britain. It was deeply unpopular. Do you feel, in a sense, that you were kind of cheated out of your Tour of Britain participation?
Yeah, I think the points criteria, I think it happened for 3 years. Yeah, 4 years. And unfortunately, it was the years I was riding for continental teams. I think it was with Team Rally, and then that merged to Vitus Pro Cycling powered by Brother. And yeah, it's my biggest regret in cycling, or like, I've never managed to race the biggest race in the UK. And yeah, it's sad. And I'm really happy now that all the British Conti riders have got the opportunity to ride it. I think it's such a big thing for a British rider. Even if they haven't got any aspirations of winning a stage or anything like that, getting around these races is hard. And being able to ride past hometowns and things like that is unbelievable. Everybody in the UK now, or the British scene, the all quality bike riders. And I think nowadays, more than ever, the levels there can compete with any World Tour team, really. As you can see in the Road Race Champs on the weekend, or last weekend, on the podium, Richardson, who is riding for St. Brandy's, he's up there with the best. So yeah, I think I'm really happy that all the teams are riding, and it will be some really, really good racing.
Absolutely. Tony, just leaping back now to the neutral service component, you won't be there this year, of course. Tour of Britain has gone back to its original supplier. But in terms of supporting a professional bike race and that vast array of technical requirements, different sponsors, different brand partners, different component manufacturers, the endless diversity, how do you cope with that?
It's difficult, and especially with what's come in with disc wheels. We now have normal caliper brakes have gone, and we've got disc wheels that have 160s on the front, 140s on the back end, the same. And then you'll have 11-speed Campag Shimano and now 12-speed Campag Shimano. And luckily, we're able to have that on board with the help of Brother. Otherwise, I think we would struggle like hell.
Yeah, interesting sort of disconnect, isn't it, between the industry and the sport? The industry wants the sport as its technical showcase, and yet, in a way, by creating all these new products, it's overloading the sport rather than supporting it. Would that be a fair analysis, Phil?
Yeah, of course, it does make life more difficult for Tony. And I can remember when the Sweet Spot approached us to support the Tour of Britain. You know, I rung Tony up and sort of said, blimey, Tony, we're going to have to really think about this, because we're going to firstly begin to have to do a lot of pre-planning now about who's riding what and which teams are coming and all these sorts of stuff, just so we can get all of the equipment in the right place, basically. And of course, not forgetting SRAM as well. We've got SRAM as well as Shimano and Campag to deal with 12-speed. So that's a hell of a variety of wheels. And you've also got to know where those wheels are on your rack. And important things like if a brake goes on the day, you've just got to make sure that you know which rider out in front of you and what group sets they're running. And the mechanic has got all of that on a piece of paper taped onto the headrest of the passenger in order that they can minimize the amount of time thinking about that. If there's a technical, well, they know it's a Shimano, it's a 12-speed, that's top left. I can leap out, grab that, effect a change. But of course, you're also dealing with the fact that there could be different rotor sizes. Then again, how the mechanic sets the rack up of a morning before they go. We did some of this as content, didn't we, Tim, at the Tour of Britain last year when we did a few walk rounds and just sort of talked to the mechanics, and they explained just kind of what's going through their minds, what things are always in their pocket to jump out with at any one time. It was an Allen key like this. And there's so much to think about. And again, in a dynamic racing environment, neutral servers would be a lot easier if everyone just had the same group set and the same gear ratios. That would make the life of Tony and his crews, and whether it also be Mavic or, you know, Vittoria, would make their life a lot simpler. But unfortunately, we just seem to be salami slicing this technology further and further and further. And it's going to be what next? Is it 13 speed group sets next? Is that what we're doing as our next one? There's a sort of real fascination. We in the printer industry, we used to call it speeds and feeds, where that's all you ever talk about is it's always going plus one on print speed or document feeder speed. And it's the same with bikes. It's plus one gear. Suddenly 12 speed is the best thing ever versus 11 speed. And for a lot of people, probably that 12 speed isn't going to make a huge amount of difference to the riding that they do at a weekend, for example. It's just that we're being sold the technology because somebody is needing to move their product category on, right? So for us at the back end of all of that, then with a diverse number of teams coming internationally to races like the Tour of Britain or UCI races, it's a real headache for the crews that need to support riders.
As Phil says, it might not benefit the consumer ultimately. Could it even be detrimental, Tony? These ever-increasing group sets, or drivetrains, I should say, require ever narrower chains.
I'm told that one company has the patent on a 15-speed block cassette. Now, whether that will ever come in, hopefully I won't see that. Because I'm sure the chain will be so thin, but I don't know. I never thought that disc brakes would come in, but everybody's on disc. I don't think there is any of the top teams now not on disc brakes. And whether they make that much difference is questionable.
I lived through that as a journalist, actually, and I was lucky enough to be invited out by Shimano to Mount Etna to ride down Mount Etna as fast as we could on their new disc brakes. And I thought at the time, and I remember writing a sanctimonious piece about, well, you know, are they really any better than rim brakes, bloody, bloody, blah, blah. And yet rim brakes now seem positively archaic. But would you consider a bike with rim brakes, Adam?
I've still got a bike with rim brakes, and my hill climb bike has still got rim brakes. It's still the lighter option. Still lighter option. And, you know, tolerances, you can work with a lot easier. Road racing nowadays, I'd have to go with disc brakes just because everybody brakes later into the bends. And if you don't, you're struggling. But on the negative side, I'm on tram 12 speed and I'm probably getting into a chain every 4 weeks. And I've got through a set of chain rings in 7 months, where you're talking about chainrings, cassette chainrings, you're talking about over £1,000, and you're thinking this is every 7 months. Unless you're sponsored by the company, it's out of price for most people. And I love the sport, and I'm kind of thinking, okay, I need a new set of tyres or a new chain. And you're thinking, what shall I work with? I'll put a bit of super glue on my tyres for a bit and get a new chain. Obviously, it's my little violin and it's third world problems as such. But if you want to be racing at the high end, it isn't, I think, an issue, and it's going to be more of an issue in the future, especially with the supply chain struggling at the moment.
And the bike manufacturers ultimately are pushing the agenda all the time. Because if you recall, we went through that period, didn't we, where pro teams were moving to disc, but then INEOS were sort of the last to go, weren't they? And you also had Chris Froome already sort of talking them down until, of course, Factor then stepped in and became the sponsor of Israel Startup Nation. And it was kind of almost to some degree sort of forced to go on to disc brake. I've just recently built another bike at home and I went with rim. And that's not because I'm sort of old school particularly. It's because I've got a couple of bikes which are disc bikes and I enjoy riding them. But I am not the type of rider. I don't race bikes. I don't go fast enough to sort of need that extra 2 or 3% of braking performance. So I'm quite happy to be pottering around on my rim brake bike, and the bike in my view still looks, you know, fantastic and performs really, really well. Sometimes we do get sold fundamentally what the technology vendors want you to buy. I mean, this is just how the industry works, isn't it? It's their job to sell you your next bike, and it all starts fundamentally with World Tour teams, like it does in F1 and all of these other elite sporting areas where technology is being used. I can remember when we were with Vitus, when, you know, you were trialing the SRAM 12 speed for the first time, tubeless tyres. There's quite a lot going on then, wasn't there, of new technology on the bikes, which you guys were pushing the boundaries of?
I think we were the first team to run disc brakes. I think that's World Tour, the first team what SRAM sponsored with disc brakes. And I think we're one of the first teams to go 12 speed. And to be fair, I do love it. And that's one of the reasons why it pains me so much to buy chains and cassettes and stuff, because I wouldn't like to go back, if I'm honest. I like my mechanical on my hill climb bike, but that's for a specific purpose, just to go up a hill fast. But for everyday riding, I do like my electric gears and things like that. I've never run out of batteries in 4 years. My rear mech has decided to pack up once or twice. That could happen. You can break a cable. So it's the same kind of thing. But yeah, neutral service though. I was in a race this year and I was on the brake, and it was a small stage race, and I punched it out the brake. It was still an amazing neutral service car, but it wasn't the brother one, and they didn't have a front wheel for me because I was on disc brakes. So I was out of the race.
It's sad. It's sad when that happens, isn't it? You know, but I don't know the answer. You know, whether, I mean, I'm sure Shimano have the same problem, but they are Shimano, so they have whatever they want. It's like Mavic. Mavic have gone, or Mavic Neutral Service was the one that everybody used to say, they're the guys, those yellow cars.
Then you have trouble with cleat platforms.
Yeah.
And shoes and stuff like that.
Oh, don't get started on cleat platforms. That's another minefield. But one thing I want to ask you, Adam, is that, Tim, you picked up this point earlier, which was around the fact that Tour Britain qualification used to be about, you know, earning the points during the National Road Series. And a lot of people were saying it highly influenced the style of racing that was then enacted in the domestic racing scene. So now that's sort of gone. Do you think, because you're actively racing all the time, Adam, so do you think it's had the desired effect where the racing's now, they used to say it was sort of a bit more controlled effectively because the teams were racing the whole season just for Tour of Britain qualification. So with that away now, do you think the racing is more free-flowing?
As such, so I love racing, and the more races I do, the better I get, where some of the youngsters have got the training programs, love the power meters, and can train absolutely amazing and just turn up to one race and be on form. I can't really do that. And because we didn't have that many races, like, I think we had, what was it, three series race, national series races, or was it two last year? Was it three?
Last year, no, I think there was more than that. I think there was about four or five.
Ah, yes, the hill climbs. I kind of missed out a few at the end. It was very much different racing. I'm not sure if it's worse or better. It was just different.
So jury's out.
Jury's out for me.
Jury's out.
I think the big teams that used to control aren't there now. You know, you've got six, maybe seven riders. You know, you can't control like you used to be able to. And there's all these teams that have got three and maybe four. They're getting into the...
It's also worth noting, though, isn't it, that we've seen the collapse of some teams. So as a result of it, we've seen the teams that are currently now qualifying for the Tour of Britain, Webwell, Tite, Saint Piran, with Sungord. A lot of the riders have just all sort of tried to cram onto those teams effectively. There's less, let's say, competitive teams, and there's fewer teams fundamentally with the same actors on that used to be competing against each other. So that in itself, which is a sort of a structural outcome of what's happening in the sport, could also be influencing the racing style. So perhaps there's a number of things going on here, Adam.
And I do think back in the day, most of the top riders were on salaries. Like in the top six teams, every rider was salaried. So I knew, I go to the team meeting the night before, and my job is either to get into the brake or let the brake go and police it. And I didn't mind that. That was my job. I loved it. But it was my job. I used to get there. And if I had to pull off with 120K to go because I've done my job, that's completely fine. Because the salaries are not there, it's more that everybody's racing for themselves. It's a little bit more selfish racing nowadays, I do think. The big teams, they can just police it a lot easier. Like if you've got two or three riders, four riders, just willing just to sit on the front, it's going to change a way the race is raced.
Yeah, I'm sure if we asked ourselves the question, you know, looking at those teams that have qualified for the Tour of Britain and just said, well, I wonder how many of the riders on there are actually salaried out of the squads that they have, I bet we couldn't count them on two hands in total in its entirety, maybe even one hand. So, you know, it's another interesting point there, Adam, where it just influences things. So maybe just sort of domestic racing is evolving at the moment as a result of this kind of just where it finds itself in. Whereas if we sort of looped back 10 years when we had the big teams with the big budgets, the Madisons and the JLTs and the NFTOs, all of these people sort of knocking around where they had really big budgets, where people were earning a living out of it. People were, what's your job? I'm a professional bike rider. So when you say professional, you're salaried. Yeah, I have a salary that I take home. And it's a good enough salary for me to buy a house, to do this and to live my life. Whereas today, I think to be a salaried rider in the domestic scene is a very, very rare thing. And would it be enough for you to buy a house, get a mortgage or anything if you were that person? I think my answer to that is a definite no.
Yeah, it's an extremely hard calling and unlikely to get any easier anytime soon. But as Adam said, the honour, the buzz of riding in the national tour is something still that everybody wants. Well, thank you very much, guys. A really interesting exploration of sides of the Tour of Britain that most people, I don't think, will explore. The race within the race, inside the convoy, the technical challenges of supporting such a technically diverse peloton, the hard and fast roles that the riders are allotted. Some really interesting angles that we've explored. As we mentioned, it starts on Sunday, September the 4th, finishes on September the 11th. Brother UK will be there again, of course, as official print and results partner. And following our success At the Women's Tour, we will be there as presenting partner of the Green Zones as well. Phil, you must be looking forward to this Tour of Britain.
Yeah, without a doubt. And I just had a thought then, which I thought was quite funny. I wonder how many of these World Tour riders had to Google the Isle of Wight.
Yeah.
Yes. Where is this place called the Isle of Wight?
And could then pronounce it.
And yeah, that's going to be some transfer, that, isn't it? To sort of roll them all on the ferry. And for the people of the Isle of Wight, it's going to be fantastic. I mean, what a spectacle to turn up there for the very final stage of the Tour of Britain. So that's fantastic to literally just see how far the Tour of Britain, because sometimes when the route comes out every year, the guys who run the social media for Sweet Spot, there's always somebody that's disappointed, isn't there? It's the Tour of Britain, but you're not coming to where I live. You know, how can you call yourself the Tour when you're not coming past my front door? It's really difficult. It's really difficult. But if you really look at the route this year, starting at the top, finishing on the Isle of Wight, it's not quite a straight line down this year, is it?
But it's not far off.
It's not far off it. Yeah, it's kind of there. We pin the map at the bottom and the line and the bits in between are quite similar. But I think it will make a spectacular ending. So I'm really looking forward to that.
I'm going to wave a flag. For the island. My mother grew up on the Isle of Wight. As a kid, I used to complain bitterly about being taken there to visit my grandparents, but it's a beautiful place. And irony of ironies, when I started writing about cycling back in 2012, literally my first job was to go and sample a sportive on the Isle of Wight, and the riding ain't easy. Everything that we've discussed about heavy roads, and there's some pretty serious climbs. It's going to end on Tennyson Down, overlooking the Needles, and the helicopter shots are going to look spectacular. Brilliant. Well, look, thank you very much again, guys. Wonderful exploration of Britain's biggest race. Adam Kenway, Tony Barry, Phil Jones, thank you very much indeed for joining me.
If you've enjoyed today's episode, please hit subscribe.